Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy, are we in the tournament now? Maybe? Week?
Maybe. Week.
Maybe?
Maybe. Before we get started, just wanted to give a quick shout-out to our sponsors, Sports Passport. You can go to sportspassport.com, check into any game you've been to, whether that's Syracuse or elsewhere. And keep track of fun stuff like record of your favorite team, the record of your least favorite team, the best games you've seen live in terms of individual performances. I know for me, I love looking at it myself and seeing 0-4 next to Georgetown. It's a very satisfying feeling on my end.
Yeah, if you were at Georgetown versus DePaul last night, the second best college basketball team of the night, definitely let us know and be sure to check in that delightful event.
Post photos of you hopefully wearing orange. Maybe.
Go DePaul.
Anyway, so last night was a lot of fun. Syracuse did what it does, which is get down by double digits, look like trash in the first half, and then come out firing to start the second half and quickly kind of, you know, knot the game up. I know they kind of grabbed the lead here and there from about the 16-minute mark until the end, but SU was within five very quickly within the second half, and I think setting the tempo the way they did and obviously shooting much better than they did in the first half, Dan, obviously set them up for what ended up being a pretty thrilling finish and another great win over a top-10 team.
It's crazy because we have this like running storyline of how unpredictable Syracuse is, but at the same time, like, every single Syracuse game is interesting and they seem to play out in similar fashion, where SU falls behind by between like 8 and 13 points and then works its way back, and it comes down to, if not the final shot, like a big shot in the last minute. I was just looking through the last game that really wasn't dramatic in down the stretch was probably Notre Dame, which was back on January 21st. So we've had over a month of just every single game, win or lose, be legitimately like a thriller till the end. I mean, the biggest deficit in any of those was what, the Florida State win, maybe, and that was even like still a pretty close game until Syracuse iced it at the end and made it a 10-point victory. Just like crazy how this team keeps on doing this, how John Dillon can like bounce between a pretty dreadful performance against Georgia Tech and then comes back and has another awesome game, not quite the 43 points against NC State, but you know, a huge 26-point game, another buzzer beater, which is what, his second or third this year. So just this team, it just does not want to make anyone's lives less stressful. win or lose, they're going to make it a quite an experience every single game. And I guess that's fun. I could probably use a couple easy wins here and there, but I guess I'll take what we get. Life. Yeah. We haven't had an easy win since BC, which was
a while ago.
I mean, that was well over a month ago now. So,
well, yeah, we've had seven straight games now where we've had double-digit deficit. We've come all the way.
That's incredible.
Yeah, we've come all the way back in six of them. Yeah, we came all the way back in six of them, Pitt being the exception. Georgia Tech ended up eking it out, and obviously Louisville beat us in overtime. But yeah. Somehow, some way, seven straight games. I know I covered this in an article on Monday that, I mean, I'm fine with it because we're winning the majority of those games by a sliver, but I don't know how sustainable this style of play is long term, just because, not just from a physical standpoint on the players. I mean, these guys are all playing, you know, 38, 40 minutes a night, but also just from the standpoint of like mentally and emotionally. I know as a fan how I feel. I can only imagine if I'm a player going out there each and every night and knowing what's on the line and knowing that you're probably going to be locked into another kind of, you know, needed buzzer beater and a heated battle with either a better team or a worse team. Doesn't really seem to matter anymore. I do feel like that catches up to you. I'm just not sure when that moment is. I thought it might have been Georgia Tech, but apparently not based on what happened against Duke.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem sustainable at all. And I think we talked about, like, you know, the guy is basically playing the whole game. Obviously, Roberson will get in and eat into minutes for Lydon / Thompson / whomever. But overall, like, they just keep on pulling it off, or at least coming close, and it doesn't really seem like people are super worn out. Now, that might change in March when the time between games drastically shortens, and you're playing, obviously, every night in the ACC tournament, or every other night, basically, in the NCAAs, but for now, I mean, it seems like maybe the one benefit of having, if not a team that's experienced in playing together, a pretty somewhat veteran group with the two grad transfer seniors and, you know, Leiden, who's coming off of a deep tournament run, and Roberson, who's been around for a while. Like, I don't think minutes are probably as big an issue as if this was a team full of freshmen, or, you know, full of guys who hadn't had that kind of experience, even if it wasn't at Syracuse.
No, completely. And yeah, I think, like, you're right. If this was a younger team, I mean, you saw a team that kind of lived and died by this mentality in... You can debate whether it was 06 or 06 to 07 or 07 08 more. I'd say 07 08 probably more because it was a younger squad. That was the first, you know, the dynasty year.
And they played six guys.
Right. They played six guys all year, so there's some similarities there. And you saw just the wheels kind of came off toward the end because injuries killed them and obviously, again, youth. In this case, there's youth, but it's offset by, like you said, the veterans on this team. I think, you know, Tyus Battle has been able to grow immensely over the course of the season because he has that veteran support. I think, you know, Frank Howard hasn't played a ton, but I feel like he's actually provided a little more value in late minutes. I'd say over the course of this stretch, he hit some nice free throws yesterday. I'm still puzzled by how well Syracuse is shooting free throws this year. It's because it's not just Gillen, it's everybody. I don't know if maybe White and Gillen being elsewhere for an extended amount of time means they didn't catch the disease where they can't hit free throws. Leiden's a pretty good free throw shooter too. I mean, this team's doing something it doesn't normally do, and it's a long time viewer of Syracuse. It's certainly puzzling, and I know you're probably feeling the same.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing that, like, really didn't make sense when they weren't playing well. Like, the fact that it was a Syracuse team that was shooting, you know, was best in the ACC. I don't know if they still are, but they're probably up there. In free throw percentage, and it was like the worst Syracuse team in a while. Now things are obviously evening out in the wins and losses, but the free throws still are a major strength. Last night they were 22 of 25. Even like Thompson, who I think was like hovering around 50% earlier in the year, has really come along. You know, he's good for, I mean, it seems like recently he's shooting more like, you know, 66-70% on the season. He's up to like 62.5. so if that's your worst guy and he's not a guy that plays nearly the amount of minutes that the, you know, the Whites and Gillens do, and he's going to hit, you know, two-thirds of them, like, you'll take that. Especially when it seems like everyone else is going to hover around 80%, which is totally invaluable, especially in these late-game scenarios. And obviously it helped last night because Duke put us on the line a decent amount down the stretch.
Yeah, I think the Duke foul trouble was very interesting last night because, you know, I didn't really notice it until they weren't just in trouble, but they were, like, completely screwed by it. I know I didn't notice that Allen had four fouls until he had them. It was great to see, especially when I think a lot of folks are really frustrated by the officiating in parts of the first half of that game. I think in the entirety of the Georgia Tech game, it seemed like there was a lot of contact that wasn't being called. I also think that, you know, Tatum's emergence in the first half and really going kind of silent in the second half was another key to this victory. There's just a lot of different nuances you can look at from this game that don't make much sense on their face, whether that's looking at, you know, Syracuse from the standpoint of what they've done in the past year, what they've done in the past week, or what they've done in the past decade. This team's strange. I don't get it. And I think shrug face is pretty much the only suitable reaction anymore.
Yeah, I think maybe the weirdest part of this game, looking at the stats, is the three-point breakdown. We had Duke shoot 33, which is probably not that crazy for them. They're a high-volume shooting team. They only hit 10, which is what Syracuse does to, you know, when Syracuse wins games against teams like this, it's when they hold them to a poor three-point shooting percentage. And the only guys who really did any real damage there are Kennard, who was 5 for 9, 8 of 19 overall for 23, so he had a nice game. Not like the most efficient game he's ever had, but he was, you know, clearly Duke's best player as he's been most of the year. And then Tatum was 3 for 7, another 13 rebounds, and had the big overall game, although, as you noted, that was mostly first half heavy. But other than that, I mean, Matt Jones was 1 for 5, Grayson Allen was dreadful, he was 1 for 8, Jackson was 0 for 4, so it just wasn't a good three-point shooting night for Duke. And Syracuse, which is also a high-volume three-point shooting team, only took 11, and they hit six, which is huge. Dylan had the three big ones. But just, like, that is probably, I don't know if that's the fewest threes that we've taken this year, but it's probably in the bottom three.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt that at all. That I can look up those numbers at some point, but that definitely makes sense. I guess doesn't make sense. That Syracuse is just, for a team that relies on threes, you did see a startlingly few of them yesterday. But I think, you know, the key to that is the fact that Duke is A, a bad defensive team, and B, a bad, very bad defensive team on the interior. I didn't get to look at the rebounding numbers, but I'm sure that they were pretty close. I think Lydon did a really nice job, especially in the second half, of picking up the slack. And you saw when Lydon was finally getting fed in the middle, when Gillen started driving the lane in the second half. I mean, his first half was not great at all. But that second half, once he started driving the lane, he was drawing contact. Whether he was getting, you know, foul calls or not was another story. But the fact that he was able to, you know, penetrate that Duke defense really easily, I think opened up that offense for a lot more opportunities. And that's when you saw, you know, shots from the perimeter start falling. That's when you saw, again, you know, Gillen really get cooking from a shooting perspective. Another thing, I know we were talking about free throws earlier. The fact that Gillen's hit, what, is it 43 or 44 now in a row? It is still kind of mind-blowing. Again, considering Syracuse's conflicted history with free throw shooting, and have we been so bad at it for so long?
That, and Lydon was, like, I think he had, like, 30-something in a row earlier in the year. Yeah, Dylan, let me see the last time he missed. I didn't realize it had gotten that high. But I think Lydon had his first miss in, like, 3 or 4 weeks at Virginia. Dylan has not missed since he was 13 for 14 in his Florida State. He followed up a 13 for 14 performance with a 14 for 14 performance. And then since, he didn't get to the line in his UVA, which is weird considering they won that game. 7 for 7, 5 for 5, 2 for 2, 2 for 2, 5 for 5. So he's on fire.
I will take it every single time. So I know Boeheim said after the game that John Gillen was kind of the motor that drives these wins and all that. I mean, Dan, we talked about the frustrating pieces around guard play this year. Do you buy what Jim's putting down here? Do you think that Syracuse truly is, you know, powered by Gillen, or do you think that there's other factors there, including Tyler Lydon, that really dictate whether or not the Orange come away with a victory?
I buy it overall. I mean, I think you have examples of, you know, you have the whatchamacallit that disproves the, or that proves the fact, but, like, so you get Pitt 20 against Pitt, which is a loss, obviously. But if you go back to, like, the UNC-Notre Dame losses, which was probably the two losses that, you know, made it seem like Syracuse didn't really belong anywhere near the top of the ACC, Gillen combined for 4 points in those two games. He had 9 against Virginia Tech on 2 of 9 shooting in that loss. He had 7 in the loss to BC. So I'm looking, in all of Syracuse's losses, he has had he had 0 against UConn. He's had double-digit points, I think, in 3 of them. In the wins, obviously, you have the 43-point game, the 26-point game last night. You had 21 against Florida State, 20 in the first game against Pitt. So I think it's pretty clear that it's not the only factor. Obviously, I don't know that many teams have, like, a single factor, but I would say that John Gillen's performance is probably the lead indicator of how Syracuse is. It doesn't mean they're going to win a game that he scores 20 in, but I think if you're getting that kind of consistent point guard play, and it does seem like his shooting also impacts his play everywhere else. It seems like he has his best overall games on games where he's shooting well as well. If we're getting that kind of point guard play, it improves everyone's game, because then you have Lydon probably getting more open looks, getting more pick and pops. You have someone who can feed the ball to Battle, and he doesn't have to be his, like, you know, taking people off the dribble one-on-one all the time. Howard has been very up and down, but, I mean, you don't have to worry about getting good Frank Howard, because he's probably not going to play very much. So, yeah, I buy it. Gillen, Bam, I think today said he was our best player. I don't know about that, but I would say he's almost definitely the most important.
Yeah, I think Tyler Lydon still has that title as best player, at least for now. I think it was frustrating for me, and I know I wasn't the only one. Even people who were a little more even-keeled on Twitter, it seemed like Donna over at Syracuse.com was even like openly tweeting like why the guards were just ignoring Lydon in the paint. I still think that Lydon is the best because, not just because of pro potential, but also just because of how versatile he is. Like, he can play like a stretch five. He can play like a three if needed. He has range on both ends. You know, he can shoot the three. He doesn't get super physical under the basket, but he can go up and get a rebound against bigger players. I think there's just a lot he can do, and I don't know if Syracuse fans are ever going to see Tyler Lydon really hit the ceiling of his potential while he's wearing orange, but I hope he does at some point, because I think he has been a really fun player for us to watch over the past 2 years, and I hope that we see many more years of it to come and a lot more development from him.
Yeah, his versatility is really huge, and I think that's where his greatest NBA potential lies. And I also that, like, when he has a bad game, he very rarely is super inefficient. Like, his bad games are when he's taking, you know, he's storing 8 points on five shots. Like, his biggest problem is when he's just not assertive enough, I think. Not that I want him taking bad shots all the time, but Lydon doesn't really have, like, he won't shoot you out of game ever. He won't take those shots at all. So I think that might be, you know, I've seen a lot of, like, oh, how can he be going to the NBA? And, you know, I have some of those questions myself, because, you know, there are nights where he disappears, but he still helps on the defensive end. He's incredibly important for the way we play now, which he's basically playing center most of the time with Thompson. Neither of them's a natural center, obviously, and he plays it well enough. I think his greatest asset there is that he's really good at avoiding foul trouble, which is he'll surrender the two and live the fight another day versus, you know, stupid fouls most of the time. So, I think he's by far the most talented guy. I think White is the most consistent, and I think Gillen is kind of the engine, like you said.
Yeah, I buy that for sure. So, Dan, looking at Syracuse's resume right now, 17-12, they got two games to play. They're 9-7 in league play. If you were the committee today, are they in?
Today, I would say they're in. I think the wins are too good. I think it's you can complain. Like, I think the combination of the wins being too good and the losses being kind of front loaded, and also if you just build the narrative for Syracuse and you have, you know, this is a team that added a bunch of pieces both through recruiting and through grad transfer market, clearly didn't gel until, you'd probably argue, like February, has gotten better during the year, has, you know, doesn't have a whole lot of road wins, but have picked up a couple recently, and plays in the ACC, which is 1-14, is just absolutely brutal. I think they're in. I think if they were to lose out, things did get hairy again. So I think that Georgia Tech game becomes huge. I think the Louisville game is kind of gravy at this point. Yeah. Although if they beat Louisville, they're definitely in. I think, honestly, if they get to 8, I think right now there's a good chance they'd be in no matter what, unless they just start to, like, fall apart. And if they win one more game, I don't see a scenario where they don't get to the tournament.
I have to agree there. I think that, you know, Syracuse is the only unranked team this year to beat three top 10 teams. I think they've got a better collection of quality wins than not just anybody on the bubble, but I think just about anybody in the tournament field. I mean, obviously there are some exceptions there with some of the, you know, one seed and things like that, but Syracuse has definitely put together a resume. I know you've tweeted about it and others have too, that's going to confound the hell out of the NCAA tournament committee for the second straight year. I mean, those bad losses are bad, and they're worse than just about anybody's in the media bubble. I wrote up a post this morning about kind of the bubble watch and what that looks like and how SU compares. The wins compare favorably. The losses don't in many cases. So it's just a question of whether or not the committee decides to prioritize those wins over those losses. So I think based on what we saw from the early reveal a couple weeks ago, it does seem like that they're looking at those wins more than the losses. I think it seemed like they forgave a lot of losses from those teams. Granted, I think a lot's changed too, obviously. Teams like Florida State, teams like Virginia, that were included in that early bit of bracketology, probably aren't there anymore. which is unfortunate for us because those are some big wins for us. But nonetheless, I do think that you're right. Syracuse is in by way of what else is on the bubble and what we know right now. But there's still a lot of opportunity for change. And the fact that the bubble is populated by a lot of major conference teams means that just like we have opportunities to play our way in for good, you know, so do a lot of other squads that are still, even if they don't have them on the schedule left like we do, they do have a conference tournament to pick up another, you know, one or two top 25 wins.
Right, and I think if Syracuse can find its way into, I don't know how they would fall out of the top eight. I guess if they lost the next two and some things got shaken up. But it looks like there's a pretty good chance that they'll end up with a first round bye. If they can pick up a nice, you know, I guess what might be likely is a third matchup with Georgia Tech, or, you know, which wouldn't be the best. But I guess, you know, in the ACC, there really isn't a great, like, option unless you're playing BC. And that would require BC to beat Georgia Tech or whomever it faces in the first round. So,
and we lost to BC this year.
And we did lose to BC this year, once upon a time, back in the dark ages of the 2016-17 season. I just overall, I think the strength of the ACC, and I think if you're looking at these teams and comparing them, even with the bad losses, I think if you're a committee member and you're trying to find the however many teams that are at large that have the best chance of actually winning the tournament, obviously there's probably only a handful of teams that can actually win the tournament, but if you're ranking them in that order of like who could actually go and do real damage, Syracuse has to be towards the top. Like they have a crazy low. I mean, early in the year, at least they had a really low floor. Who really knows how low that floor is now? Because even in the losses recently, they're playing every team close. And even like the North Carolina game, like wasn't a total rout until the end. Notre Dame was not all that close ever, but like even when they weren't playing well, outside of the freaky St. John's and Boston College games, like the losses were bad. But they weren't, like, devastating every game except for those two. And, you know, Wisconsin blew them up. Wisconsin's pretty good. I just think, you know, Syracuse, you're getting a team that can go and, you know, as they've proven, can go beat a two seed in this tournament or a three seed. Now, who knows what they, you know, if they would actually be able to beat North Carolina in a rematch or if they could go out and beat a Kansas. But I don't think there are that many other teams in the bubble that have as good a shot at even that than Syracuse does.
Right. And I think that, you know, a lot of this is a little bit of a leap of faith on our part towards, you know, what the committee's thinking is, but it does boil down to, do they value not just, I guess, do they want to take an optimistic viewpoint on teams? They want to take a pessimistic viewpoint on teams. So, like, you know, what can Syracuse do? Well, Syracuse can lose to St. John's by 33, or they can lose to Boston College. Or what can Syracuse do? Syracuse can beat Duke at the buzzer. Syracuse can beat Virginia when no one's supposed to be able to beat Virginia, who had with a double-digit lead. You know, Syracuse can beat Florida State, who seemed like just team personnel-wise, they were just better equipped to beating them. So, like, looking down the list, we can get into this list in a few. It does seem like Syracuse grades out very well on the potential front, but again, it just depends how much the committee allows potential to guide their decision versus the raw numbers, which, depending on which metrics you use, don't always help SU out a ton.
Right, and the bubble is just super messy this year, so it's a lot of it's going to be on how the committee values individual things, and that changes year to year. So it's hard to really project. I guess if you're looking at last year, you'd feel pretty good. Syracuse got in on, you know, what could have even been a shakier resume, especially considering how they ended the season. But, you know, things to be totally flopped this year. They could be way more friendly towards mid-majors. There could be some weird tournaments things where some bids are stolen, although it doesn't seem like that's all that likely based on the current mid-major, you know, how things are working out there. And overall, like, there just aren't that many impressive bubble teams. Like, I think it feels like every year now we say the bubble's weak, but the bubble really seems weak this year. So Syracuse could use it to their advantage and sneak in and grab like a 10 or 11 seed. And I guarantee you we'll be hearing all about last year's team if that happens, because that's all anyone's going to talk about, you know, in any matchup we're in, especially if we end up against some power teams if we get to the second and third rounds.
That's all anybody's talking about now, interestingly enough. I know I've already seen a couple mentions of it. No, you brought up the weak bubble, and I've been avoiding the word if I can, just because I know over the other day over on SB Nation, I know Mike Rutherford from Card Chronicle had a whole thing about how the weak bubble's a bit of a fallacy, and spelled out a couple of reasons why. I think he's right, but I think the word we've used it here, you know, confusing, messy, I think that's a little more accurate, just because I think that there isn't, it's not weak, there's just very little demarcation between the teams. And it really just depends on, you know, what you want to look at with regard to each. There's obviously, again, depends on the metrics, depends on all that. Before we jump into that, I think that's a good second half topic. Figured we'd jump into halftime here. But before we do, wanted to give another shout out to our friends over at Sports Passport. Again, you can go to sportspassport.com. You check into every game you've been to in the four major sports. MLS is on there. You can go to college football or basketball. You know, share your experiences there as a literal passport to the sports and sporting events you've been to. So, again, you know, I've checked in. I think it was, last I looked, it was like 80-something times at the Carrier Dome, and that's football and basketball, so a little bit of an advantage on every other venue. Dan, did you get to fill out your passport since we last spoke?
I started to. I haven't done like a full evaluation, but I think soon I will. I added a couple of the ones I've been to this year, so I am looking forward to getting on there and finding like an hour or two to fully go through all the games I can remember, and hopefully get at least a decent pick. I'm actually this weekend. I'm down here in South Carolina with some friends this week, so I'm actually going to be at the South Carolina versus Tennessee basketball game on Saturday afternoon. So I will get to experience SEC basketball, the league that everyone always tells you you need to watch out for, I think.
Oh man, that league is fire. I don't know what I would want more than watching
to watch a 55 to 52 game at, you know, actually what is actually supposed to be a pretty nice arena. South Carolina actually is a pretty big one, but still, yeah.
Sign me up. All right.
So exciting.
So yeah, looking, just to give Sports Passport a little bit more love, excuse me, clear my voice, venues I've been to the most, Carrier Dome at 81, Dodger Stadium 27, Staples Center 16, but has the advantage of three different teams that play there, and I've been to at least a few from each, Oracle Arena, surprisingly high, at 11, and this is why I say the Warriors fans are trash. Because I was there when I could get in for $20 and nobody else cared about the team. And I saw them booing the ownership group that ended up delivering them a title. But whatever. And then to round out the top five, it's actually a tie between AT&T Park and Shea Stadium. R.I.P. Shea.
R.I.P. I would imagine the Dome's probably number one for me as well, just because 4 years of basketball and football and lacrosse and everything else. But City is probably going to be close when I actually go. I mean, I've been to at least like 30 or 40 games in City now. Probably more, so.
I've only been to three, admittedly. But that's because I live 3,000 miles away.
Yeah, I mean, that's more than I've been to in the West Coast, so.
Fair.
Granted, I have a lot less reason to head out that way, although I would like to get back to that way sooner than later.
Come hang out. You should find tickets to the Rose Bowl. We can go.
Maybe.
I will say it's worth the hype.
Oh, I would love to go to the Rose Bowl.
I know everybody writes about this the first time they go. Like, I mean, I've been to the Rose Bowl for UCLA games a bunch, but when you go for the game, there's just a very different vibe. It's a very different experience. I mean, I got to sit around a lot of trash Oregon fans, so that was another experience. But in general, just a very cool vibe, a very cool atmosphere. Friends of mine used to live like right off the main drag on Colorado in Pasadena. So I actually went up there early on New Year's Eve, grabbed a parking space, stayed the night, and then woke up early for the Rose Parade and everything else. It was just really, really cool. So again, would I know it's not feasible for a lot of people, but would highly recommend it for those who at some point in their lives want to check that off the bucket list.
When Syracuse makes it, I will be there.
That probably won't happen, but I have some faith, I guess.
It's definitely on the short list.
Fair enough. All right, why don't we talk about a little bit of beer? Dan, what have you been drinking?
It's been another pretty big week back to back. So on Sunday, I went over to Three's Brewing in Brooklyn, which I had not been to. They had some like can sale event for like they had a bunch of beers from all over.
Aaron speaks very highly of them all the time.
Yeah, like their beer's pretty good. The space is awesome. Like they have a nice outdoor patio, and they have it's a really cool spot I hadn't been to before. And it was a gorgeous day in New York. It was like 60, like low 60s. So I had their Unreliable Narrator, which is a very juicy IPA, quite good. I had they had a collaboration with McKellar Brewing called Seeking Panacea, which was absolutely delicious. Then they had some brews from some other places nearby. There's a Hudson Valley brewery called Industrial Arts. Had their IPA Power Tools, which is probably the best thing I had that day. Really, really citrusy, really fresh. Just like a really solid IPA. I hadn't actually had anything from them before. But now I would like to go up there at some point, because they're not too far from the city. I'm in South Carolina last night. I had D9 Brewing, which is in North Carolina's Ezekiel 2517 Black Sour, which was super interesting. It comes in like kind of a light coffee beer, and then it goes to the sour, and it like both flavors are very, very present. I had the Witterkirk Wild from a brewery, a long Belgian name I don't want to pronounce, which was quite good. I had a Palmetto Trail Ale, which is a solid just pale ale from RJ Rockers Brewing, which is really nice. I had not a South Carolina beer, obviously, but Ballast Point, their Peppermint Victory at Sea, which was very good. I thought they did a nice job. Like, it's not overwhelmingly minty at all, but it blends nicely with the normal Victory at Sea flavor. And then White Tie from Westbrook, which is, you know, a brewery that we talk about a fair amount on here, a South Carolina brewery. Unfortunately, not very close to Columbia or Charleston, where I'll be this weekend. Really nice, drinkable white. I'm currently drinking a Westbrook Doza, which I bought a six-pack of, because I'm here. So, not the worst way to spend a Thursday afternoon. And one of the other better ones I've had recently, D9 Brown Sugar Brown Cow, which is pretty sweet, but not like outrageously so. Just really nice flavor. Also super drinkable. Kind of reminds me of like a souped-up like Magic Hat 9, but not as fruity, but the brown sugar flavor is definitely present without being like obnoxious.
Interesting.
I think that's my full list.
You might have beaten me again this week. I've been slacking lately because we've been doing kitchen remodel crap, and that has prevented me from doing anything. Some things that I've been drinking. Last night I had a Dinosaur World from Modern Times. Modern Times has kind of gotten on the hazy train, along with a lot of other West Coast breweries. So that's been, it's been disappointing to see everybody jump on that hype, but it's also been interesting to see who has done a good job with it and who hasn't. I think Modern Times has done a really nice job with it. A lot of folks have heard about Monk is doing a really good job with it. I think Highland Park around here has done a pretty good job balancing kind of hazy and non-hazy IPAs. I still love myself a nice, crisp West Coast IPA that doesn't taste like orange juice, but I'm increasingly in the minority there. Had some Luponic Distortion from Firestone Walker that's regularly available for anyone who has access to Firestone stuff. And then I had a Foam Tap from Beechwood, which I've mentioned a couple different times, and also some Mash and French Toast from the brewery. Mash and French Toast is a barley wine from them. It's barrel-aged. They also use some maple syrup, some cinnamon. Didn't totally taste like French toast, but I understood the basic concept there. From Craftsman, I had an Acorn Saison that was very, very good. Then also had a Windows Up IPA from Alpine over at Mediterráneo in Hermosa Beach. I was bummed because I think they might not have Blind Pig on anymore from Russian River. And that was unfortunate. But also grabbed, hadn't had it yet, the Give Me Stout or Give Me Death from Stone that they did over in Virginia. It was a Imperial Stout with, I think it was raspberries and boysenberries maybe. And that was pretty cool. So yeah, that was everything for me.
Very nice.
Indeed, indeed. Okay, so back to the bubble that we were talking about earlier. Again, mentioning the article that I wrote earlier today, kind of broke down, you know, who's above Syracuse on the bubble, who's below it. And the five teams that I isolated above, this is all according to Bracket Matrix. Kansas State, Cal, Marquette, Seton Hall, and TCU. All currently listed above. But you look at these resumes, and I don't know about you, Dan. I'm not super impressed with anyone's outside maybe Kansas State, but even Kansas State, like, and Cal too, like, just haven't looked great recently. I think that our resume does shine brighter than anything that Marquette, Seton Hall, or TCU has put together so far.
Yeah, I think Marquette might have the
Trump guard, Nova.
They have the Nova win, and the Creighton win is pretty nice. Not what it was, but still decent. So they have like the one the matching wins. I just don't think that the Big East provides like the same depth of as the ACC. Obviously, also the fact that St. John's like kind of bad. So I'm reading your article now, and like actually ended up beating a lot of these teams is pretty funny. But like you said, I think. Just in general, like there's nothing really flashy on most of these. Obviously, Kansas State has some nice wins in the Big 12, but the other West Virginia good teams, I don't know that they're any better than. I don't think that would stand that up compared to beating Duke, Virginia, and Florida State. At best, it's like, you know, R3 versus their 2, even if you want to say that Baylor and West Virginia would be among the top 4 in the ACC, which I don't know that I buy. Cal, you know, if they had beaten Oregon last night, then that would have been nice. But of course, Dylan Brooks pulled a John Gillen. So yeah, it's just, none of these really, I don't know how you argue matter of factly that, any of these teams is like head over heels better than Syracuse. And I think that's what we were talking about before. It's just, though you can kind of point to any metric you want and get the answer that you're looking for. It's not like there's one team that definitively like checks all the boxes compared to another.
Yeah, I think that really is the trouble with this bubble. Not to go into a Dr. Seussian rhyming scheme, but yeah, that there's nothing that really differentiates these teams besides maybe a couple numbers on the RPI or a couple numbers in strength of schedule. And so I that's why I think I'm leaning on quality of wins, and yeah, none of these teams are head and shoulders above Syracuse. Like if any of them were left out instead of Syracuse, I mean, the only thing you might be able to point to is total losses. It's unlikely that Kansas State finishes with, you know, any better than, you know, one less loss than Syracuse. Cal probably finishes with less losses or fewer losses. Apologies for the grammar police that is always out in full force on Syracuse posts. Marquette, same deal, could finish with 11 or 12, just like us. Seton Hall, again, 7 and 8 in the Big East, they don't really buy it. And then TCU probably finishes with as many, if not more, losses than us. So that's the group above Syracuse. The group below, I don't really think any of them have a compelling case. I think that like we're probably the demarcation line. In terms of like who's reasonably in and who's reasonably out. But Dan, that list for you, if you haven't seen it, Illinois State, Georgia Tech, Tennessee, Clemson, and Wake, none of those teams really possess the type of wins that earlier group does, even TCU, that they don't have a huge, huge quality of resume in terms of wins, but they do have a number of wins and a number of wins against bubble teams.
Yeah, Illinois State's interesting because you could always, like, outwardly wonder if they'll just, you know, give more credence to a mid-major, especially when there's, you know, a bunch of middling power conference teams. And they're 24-5. Obviously, they could go and you know, win their conference, but that, you know, isn't always dyed in the wool for any team. And then Georgia Tech, I mean, a lot of that's going to be, you know, if it comes down to Syracuse and Georgia Tech beats Syracuse twice, that's a really hard argument to make for SU. Obviously, it wouldn't be the first time that a team has gotten in over another one that beat it twice, but, you know, it's still sticky. Clemson, Tennessee, like, Clemson's had just a really rough stretch this year. They've had so many games that they were right in and just couldn't finish. They just don't have a lot of great wins. Their ACC records is not going to end up being very good. Tennessee, like the SEC, I don't think it's done I saw some people saying the SEC was on it more than like four teams in, which I struggle to find that. That league is just not deep. Nope. So, yeah, it's just, none of these teams impress me all that much. And obviously we're working from like a pretty strong Syracuse bias here, but even so, like, I don't expect, unless one of these teams goes on a crazy conference tournament run, it's hard for me to think that they're going to have anything close to like a trump card over Syracuse. It, at best, like, you could point to like some individual things that give them an edge, but in terms of like the totality of the evidence, I don't know that there's going to be a team that looks a lot better. And Syracuse has, you know, the big wins, like, which we always say that's the best thing that Syracuse has on its resume, and I don't know that another one of these teams will even be able to come close to matching that, unless like Kansas State gets a couple lucky draws in the Big 12 tournament and wins a couple of huge games. Maybe that's the only one.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said, in general, like the fact that this is the plus and minus, I guess, that since it is devoid of mid-majors, we don't have to necessarily worry about bid stealing as much, Illinois State being the only mid-major on here, but at the same time, since there are so many power conference teams here, all of them will have an opportunity to face better teams and continue to bolster that resume. You know, whether or not they take it is a different story. Illinois State, even, you know, looking at their total wins, that's a two-team conference this year with Illinois State and Wichita. And based on the current records, there's no way those teams can face each other before the Missouri Valley Championship game. So it's not as if, you know, Illinois State could beat Wichita State in the semifinals and then lose in the final and then be able to get in by strength of record. Anyway, there is no situation for Illinois State to improve its station. I think that, you know, 24-5 and they'll probably end up being, you know, around the 25, 26, 27 win range in there when the season's over. Sounds great, but if they, I know right now, the last time they faced Wichita State, they lost by 41. If they lose to Wichita State again in the Missouri Valley Championship by that many points, I don't necessarily know if the committee looks fondly at that, given, again, the lack of real quality wins here. I mean, the best thing that they can hold other than one win over Wichita is a loss to TCU, which isn't great.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it does seem like, and I'm not like backing this up with any actual hard evidence, but based on feel, it does seem like the committee is more loath to giving credit to those mid-majors that don't win their tournament and have like a couple, like when they play a legit team like Wichita, who's obviously pretty proven on a national stage, get blown out. Like, it just doesn't seem like those teams often get the benefit of the doubt when it comes to at-large bids.
No, absolutely not. I think, you know, Illinois State's biggest problem this year is the fact that, A, it's a two-team conference, and B, the fact that Wichita State is a proven commodity. I think if they have to choose, like if neither team wins the Missouri Valley, that bid's going to Wichita. And that's unfortunate for Illinois State because they've done a really nice job this year and kind of revitalized the program with a really strong season. But nonetheless, there's no clear-cut way to do... There's no clear-cut way to avoid the bias that inherently creeps in during this tournament selection process, and I think Wichita State would end up beating them out if the bid was between those two schools.
Yeah, I think that I think that makes a lot of sense. And that benefits Syracuse. I mean, we probably don't want to admit it, but if you're going to have inherent bias towards named programs, games. Like, Syracuse clearly gets the benefit of the doubt there, and I think it would be, I think it would be probably a little naive to think that that might not play in. Obviously, there's a lot of people that will always scream anti-Syracuse bias about everything, but I think, honestly, yeah, that's fine, whatever. Honestly, like, it's more likely that you know, they look at Syracuse, said, you know, last year we had questions about them, they made a Final Four run. I don't think that that should really matter, but it might sneak into the back of people's minds or just kind of, like, subconsciously influence how people look at the Orange.
Oh, completely. And again, like, looking around, there's just, you know, even if you go to Bracket Matrix and you look, there are no mid-majors, like, hovering in the darkness, you know, beyond this list, too. I mentioned, you know, in kind of the conclusion of the post, the next few teams, like Providence, Rhode Island, sort of, but I think Rhode Island's there mostly because of the hype that they came in on when the season started, not necessarily the body of their work now. The A-10's a good league, though, so you never know. They do have opportunities to pick up some more quality wins. Houston and American Athletic, just, it has a few good teams, and that's really it. If Houston's going to have to probably get to the championship game of that league, and beat, like, at least Cincinnati, if not SMU, too, in the process to make that happen. And then Vandy, you know, we discussed this with Tennessee in terms of, you know, just how terrible the SEC's depth is. Vandy's going to be hard-pressed without knocking off, you know, a Florida or a South Carolina or Kentucky to improve its own station, which, and unfortunate for those teams, but definitely helpful for us. As everything comes together, I mean, bid steal. I think for me this year, I'm more concerned not about bid stealing, you know, from mid majors and low majors. I'm more concerned about bid stealing from power conferences because we've seen it happen a few times. The SEC had those couple years where, like, Georgia was like a 14 seed, and Mississippi State was like a 13 seed because they managed to pull like three or four straight upsets to win their conference tournaments and then get auto bids. But yeah, I think that's the big place to be concerned, because obviously if you're hanging around that bubble, you've only got so much wiggle room for anybody else to lose. I think the other conferences to watch beyond the power leagues, West Coast Conference, obviously, if anyone besides Gonzaga or St. Mary's wins, that creates a problem. Should keep an eye on Missouri Valley. A-10 as well, if someone outside those top couple teams is able to come away with something, that'll be interesting. But yeah, I think it really does come down to those larger conferences more than the smaller ones this year.
Yeah, and I'm glad that reassures me that I should definitely be wholeheartedly supporting the Gamecocks against Tennessee this weekend, both to help one of the teams that we lost to, and not Tennessee. I mean, that would probably end to any hope of Tennessee getting an at-large. So,
yeah, I would agree. I mentioned in the article Tennessee's resume really isn't great, so I can only imagine if they suffer another loss to anyone, but especially a top team that they would really need to beat. I don't see that working out well for them.
Yeah, definitely not. They're just not very good.
No, not at all. Now, to end our show, we get to play everybody's favorite game, Bracketology.
If we're doing the latest SB Nation one, does not have Syracuse in, because it's from before the Doom. Yeah.
But still worth it. I think we can use it as a barometer, give Chris a plug. And Chris is one of the most accurate, if not the most accurate, annually bracketologists on the web. So definitely worth reading his stuff. Say read different things if you want, but if you're going to read one, I think Chris is the way to go. So
do we want to just put ourselves in for Clemson?
Where's Clemson right now?
11 in the play-in against Wichita State.
Yeah, that's fine. Let's just do that.
Okay, fine.
That's fine with me. Okay, so looking at the East bracket first, VCU Villanova could be a really fun game in the second round, not gonna lie, and I would be tempted to pick VCU, but I won't. I'm going to West Virginia in the top half. West Virginia's a 4 seed. I got West Virginia over Villanova in the Sweet 16. In the bottom half, looking over everything. I've got Florida over Duke in the Sweet 16, and then give me Florida over West Virginia in the Elite Eight.
West Virginia Notre Dame to be a really interesting one. I know Notre Dame has kind of been sloppy lately, but obviously when they play well, they're really dangerous. West Virginia plays like a totally different style of like bully ball that has had mixed results in the tournament. I think, you know, they've been best when they've been really talented and not as much like the team that just punks people up and down the court with the press, but, you know, that's not the most shocking thing in the world. Yeah, this is an interesting one. Out of the top, I'm going to stick with Nova. Obviously, like you said, the VCU matchup could be really interesting. We've seen VCU do that to teams that have been number one, number two seeds before, and they're pretty good this year. From the bottom, Duke's definitely most talented. I'm not buying Duke. Like, I think if Duke was as good as their talent says, like, they probably would have beaten us last night. And I know, you know, it was a final buzzer, you know, buzzer beater by Gillen and everything. But Duke, like, it just, I'm not convinced that they're all the way there. I know they had 7 wins in a row before that. But, like, Florida, I have trouble with. The SEC, just total mess. Although I do think Florida's pretty good. I'm, like, almost tempted to just go like crazy and pick, like, Xavier. But I won't. I guess I'll go with Florida. I guess they're probably more consistent, and Duke, I just have a bad taste in my mouth with Duke after last night's team. Or a good taste, but not for Duke. So I'll go with Florida. I'll take Nova over Florida.
Fair enough. Looking down at the West, this is another interesting one. I think OK State Gonzaga sounds like a fun game. I think Gonzaga Michigan sounds like an awful game. I'm definitely believing in Butler here. I think Wisconsin's kind of fallen back of late. So I'm actually going to take Butler out of the top half. And in the bottom half, there's a lot of uneven teams here. You know, you're seeing your Maryland's, Florida State, Oregon. I don't believe in any of these teams in any way, shape, or form. But I'm going to go with Oregon. And that means that I'm picking Butler over Oregon to get to the Final Four.
Out of the top, I'm going to go with Wisconsin. I think Wisconsin might get it going for the tournament here. I think they're experienced. They have some nice players. They have, you know, they've been here before. I think they have a solid roster overall, even if they've kind of, I mean, it's not really their fault if they played in the Big Ten, and the Big Ten doesn't give you anything. So, like, I think Wisconsin might be better than this. They just don't get, like, big opportunities at all. I know they've had some, like, weird games. Butler's good. I could see either of those. Gonzaga would still kind of, I know, we're both on, like, the Gonzaga has to prove it to us train here.
That's fine, because they do.
Whether it's fair or not. Yeah, I think they do. How many times are they going to be a top seed and not do it? So, I'll go Wisconsin. Out of the bottom, I'm going to go Florida State. I know I've been kind of pro-Oregon, I guess, you know, at this moment in time, which is, you know, since I didn't look at this until just now, is how we're doing this. Florida State just, I think that they've overcome their losses, and there's just no dominant team that's just rolling through people this year, so one loss doesn't scare me away too much. I realize what I just said about Duke, but I'm going to stick with it and act like this is not hypocritical. Florida State, I like their deep rotations. I think that could work well in the tournament. They have size, they have two guys who could really score. I just really like that team overall. So I'm going to take Florida State over Wisconsin to go to the Final Four.
All right. Looking up at the South, the top right region there. Looking down this list, and Cincinnati and North Carolina would be a really fun game. But I do think UCLA-North Carolina is a more likely game in the Sweet 16. I'm going to go with North Carolina. And that one, I think the heels have really kind of hit another gear of late, especially after what they did to Louisville last night. Then looking at the bottom here, I don't really want to pick Kentucky, but I feel like I might have to. SMU is also pretty scary. That said, if we're subbing in Syracuse for Clemson, Kentucky can beat Syracuse. I know that. So I'm just gonna say Syracuse probably loses to SMU and just ends it there. This is a little bit of chalk. I'm going to go I will go Kentucky over Baylor, and then I'm going to go North Carolina over Kentucky in the Elite Eight.
Yeah, this is a tough one. The bottom, especially. North Carolina, I think, is really good. Although, if this plays out the way it says here, I'd be pissed if I was UNC and had to face Miami in round two.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know. I don't remember off the top of my head what those two teams have done this year in their head-to-heads. But, like, it's like the Marquette-Syracuse game back.
It's unnecessary.
It's so stupid. Like, I haven't looked. There are spots here where you could switch Miami and Michigan.
Done.
Well, I guess you couldn't do that. But you could switch Northwestern and Oklahoma State, or Miami and, I don't know, you could do something. I just gave two that you couldn't do. you could switch Miami and USC, I'm pretty sure, and it'd be fine. But yeah, so it's just unnecessary. I think North Carolina, on paper, is the best team in the top. UCLA, I think they have a high ceiling, but I could see them just flaming out. So I feel best about North Carolina there. Even Cincinnati, like, I'm not quite sure what they are. I know their record's really impressive.
They look dangerous, but yeah, it's the seed doesn't help them out. They face a dangerous UTA team, and then they have to face UCLA. Like,
right. And I think UCLA is just like Cincinnati plays really well, and they're, you know, a scrappy bunch, but UCLA is so talented. I would have trouble picking them in that one. So I'll take UNC. I could see UCLA taking it for sure, but I think UNC is just too consistent, and they have the experience. In the bottom, SMU, I've admittedly not watched that much of. I know they're a pretty impressive club. I think I'd roll with Kentucky here, and I think Kentucky's a very flawed team. They're quite talented, but they haven't looked good, like, in a while now. They struggled with Mizzou the other night, who's pretty bad. Baylor, I'm not buying. Michigan State, I think, is, like, we're talking about Syracuse maybe getting in on rep. Michigan State's floating on rep even harder. Like, they are just not a very good team. And, like, St. Mary's, I don't think this is, like, this is a good St. Mary's team. I don't think they're great. It's just a weird group.
They're probably a tournament team, but yeah.
Right. I just don't know that I buy them. You know, maybe they could beat Baylor. It wouldn't shock me, but I don't think they would beat Kentucky. So I'll go with the Wildcats, and I'm not even as high on them as I was like a couple weeks ago. If Syracuse was in that Clemson spot, I don't think any of these are like super easy matchups, but it's definitely I could see Syracuse making a run. Like, I could see Kentucky just being totally flummoxed by the zone, or I could see Malik Monk dropping 50. It's one of those for sure. So I'll take UNC over Kentucky in that one.
Fair enough. And then I realized that I actually skipped the top right, because that was my fault. So looking at the last bracket, the Midwest, we've got Kansas as a one seed. I like Kansas to get at least past the first two rounds. Actually, I like Kansas to get the Elite Eight. It depends on what you believe in Purdue. I think Creighton's on the way down. I think actually an Illinois State Creighton game is ripe for an upset. But yeah, I think Kansas actually gets the easiest path of all the one seeds here, despite being the designated two out of the ones. And then looking at the bottom half, Virginia's not going to be a six at this point. I think they're fading fast. I think Middle Tennessee would actually beat them. I think Louisville still has some problems that they need to work out. They're one of the most talented teams in the country, don't get me wrong, but they're definitely flawed a little bit. And an Iowa State matchup, I think Iowa State's been rising quite a bit of late. I'm going to take Arizona out of the bottom half. And then I'll take Kansas over Arizona in that Elite Eight, continuing my my clear and distinct bias against the Arizona Wildcats.
It's Arizona slander over here. Yeah, I could see Purdue coming up huge. Like, Swanigan's scary, but their overall team doesn't really impress me too much. Kansas, I just have a feeling Kansas needs to go on a run at some point, and what better spot than this when they have three dynamic guards and are finally, you know, they're playing as well as they ever do. They won the Big 12 for the a millionth time in a row last night.
Manageable bracket.
And yeah, this would be very bad. Like, Dayton, I don't think you ever really want to see Dayton and Virginia Tech can get up, and they play hard. Creighton's, like, none of these aren't easy, but I just like Kansas a lot more than any of these teams in the top half. Virginia is a six. Like, who would have thought a couple weeks ago?
They're going to be a seven when the new bracketology comes out.
Probably.
And that's going to be horrifying for whoever's at 2.
I will say, well, at least Michigan State's not here as the 11, which would be hilarious. Is it Virginia that gives Louisville all kinds of problems? Is that the matchup?
Yes,
that,
it is.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Iowa State, I'm not buying. I'm not going to be folded down by them. I think we've had Arizona, Louisville the last couple weeks in one of these spots. I'm just out of Virginia. I just don't think they have I don't think they have the go-to guy. I think Parentes has been kind of thrust. That's not a word. Thrust into that role, and I don't think that he's well equipped to do it. There's no Brogdon. There's no Joe Harris. I think they would get by Middle Tennessee, but you never know. We've seen Middle Tennessee do things before, obviously. I think I would go Arizona versus Louisville. I think I'd stick with Louisville, although that's a really tough matchup. So I'd have the 1 and 2. I think I took Louisville last week in this exact matchup. I think I'm going to take Kansas this week.
All right. So our final four, and we're running up against time. My final four was Florida versus Butler on one side and Kansas and North Carolina on the other. I'm going with Florida, North Carolina, and giving North Carolina the title.
I have, I believe I have Villanova. I don't think, did I give a winner of Villanova, Florida? I don't remember what I said.
I think you were riding with Nova, I recall.
Yeah. So I have Nova, Kansas. I would take Kansas to stop Nova from repeating. And then in the bottom, I was a little more interesting and had Florida State versus North Carolina. That's tough. A little ACC matchup.
Wouldn't it be Nova versus Florida State?
Is that how this is? Is it East versus... Oh, you're right. Okay, I'm wrong. I got confused by how they laid this out. So yeah, it'd be Nova versus Florida State. That's tough, too. And then it would be Kansas versus UNC, which would be fun. I think I would go Kansas, and I think I would go... I think ultimately I'd go Villanova. I feel a little better about them than Florida State, although Florida State is impressive in a lot of ways. And I guess I would take Kansas to knock off Nova in the final and win the title.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I think that's everything for this week. I know it's kind of abrupt. I've got an engagement in a couple minutes to get to. But, Dan, thank you as always for joining. Very much appreciate the adjusted schedule this week.
Yes, thank you for making it easy on me here.
Of course, of course. And thank you, everybody, for listening. This is Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, whatever other service you use. And go Orange.
Go Orange.